Back, I think April has been the busiest travel month I've had in quite some time. The good news is I'm going to be here throughout all of May. So no travel in May. But yeah, this has been a very busy travel month. In fact, I get on an airplane early tomorrow morning. So just got off an airplane, have to get on another airplane. So travel isn't what it used to be, I can tell you that. So, and it's also been a really busy time at Reasons to Believe. A lot of writing's going on. I'm working on three books right now, in addition to all the speaking. And as I told you last time I was here, we're in the process of trying to buy a new building. And I got more good news. I mean, last time I told you that we got a killer loan rate from Bank of America, 3.88% for 5 years, and 1.99% for a year before that. And the going rate is 5% for commercial property with 1 or 2 points, and they gave it to us for just 1 point. But since I last saw you, our credit union jumped in and said, well, if Bank of America is going to give you 3.88, we'll give you 3.8, and we'll only charge you 0.5 point. And then Bank of America came back and said, well, how about 3.75? Well, and finally, yeah, the bidding war got started, and finally I told both our credit union, Bank of America, look, whoever has the lowest bid by 4:30 today, because I'm busy, I can't have this bidding war going on forever. 4:30 today is the deadline, and I got 6 bids in the course of that day.
Wow.
And at 4:29 p.m., Bank of America called and said, 3.35%, no points, fixed for 7 years. So, which is actually a lower rate than what we've been getting on our investment. So kind of what our board says, grab the loan. And, let's see if we can. We're putting 50% down. So we're basically taking out a loan for 50%. And the board said we could have put down a little bit more, but the board said, we got other purposes for the money. And moreover, we can invest the money for better than that 3.35%. So it's looking really good. And just Friday afternoon, escrow closed. We now own the building. So 3 miles south of where we are now. And it's got more than double the square footage. And we got room for a TV studio. TV video production studio, which we didn't have in our old building. And we actually have a classroom that we can use for events. And Ross, we think we may even be able to use it for a skeptics forum. So seats 250 people. So,
is it a move or is it a condition?
Well, it's a 3 mile move from where our building is right now. And the other good news is the Teamsters own the building. And they're occupying about 35% of the building that we're buying. And they looked at our building and said it's perfect for our needs. So the bottom line is they want to rent our building. And we already signed a tentative lease, again, just this Friday. So they'll be paying us rent while we move into their building. And then they'll be paying rent while we move out of our building. So, and I said, look, this is going to be complicated. I said, we're going to be moving into your downstairs, which is now vacant. That's most of the building, and building that to suit our needs. And then we'll move our downstairs people out of our building, and they'll be able to build out what they need. And then the upstairs people will move. And I said, are you willing to cooperate with us? Because this is going to be a fairly complex move. They said, we'll do whatever is necessary to make this work. So, it's really good. Pardon me? Well, we're looking at bringing them to the Lord. So so we'll see how that goes. Well, the first thing we're going to be doing is putting in the stuff we need, because we want to have our warehouse downstairs and our studio downstairs and get the classroom equipped. And actually, I'm getting on the airplane tomorrow. Part of what I'm doing on that airplane is negotiating with a potential donor to outfit the electronics in our studio and classroom. So we get the grant. That's going to make possible a lot of things we can't do right now. But that's something you can pray for. because it depends how much money I can raise, what we can do, what we can't do. And that basically pertains to me, because a lot of the cost is getting the building outfitted. That's the main reason why our board wanted us to get this building, because we actually went to the city of Glendora first and said, can we add a second story to our current building? And basically they said yes, but they put so many requirements in it, it was roughly going to be three times the cost of trying to buy the same space. So that's when the board said, forget about trying to satisfy the city of Glendora. Let's find a building that will really suit our needs. So that's how it all got started, because we had no intention of moving. We said, let's just add a few thousand square feet to our current building and do what we want to do, but that didn't work out. So this is actually a far more cost-effective option than what we're looking at before. So,
what's the relative sizes of these again?
Well, the building we're in right now is 11,000 square feet. The building we're moving into is 26,000. So, it actually has everything we need to be able to... Because what we realized, the building we're in really restricted what we could do in the way of outreach and trying to service different video and TV options. This new building will enable us to do all that. So, but hey, a lot of pressure is on me to raise the rest of the funding we need to make all this work. It's going to mean a lot of travel. I don't like traveling for fundraising, but I'm going to have to get used to it. So.
And how many people are being housed in this as far as office and workspaces?
Their staff is less than ours, but you know, they're now occupying 10,000 square feet. They'll be moving into 11,000, and they were paying taxes because they were Teamsters. We won't have to pay taxes because we're nonprofit. So, and that was a huge cost of the building that we're purchasing.
Yeah, but how many people are you? Do you have working there now that we'll be moving on?
We have 35, but we wanted room to be able to expand our scholar team. I mean, right now we can only handle one visiting scholar at a time. And we have several teams of visiting scholars that want to come. And so this building will allow us to actually have a team come and work together. And, you know, for people that are not working full-time and say, like, for example, we have five medical researchers, people with MDs, PhDs, that want to write a book, but they want to be able to come in teams of two and three. And so the new building will allow them to do that. So we're excited. Great option. So I appreciate your continued prayers, because there's still a lot of details to be worked out. So I walked into the class. Several of you asked me if I was up to date on some of these discoveries. Actually, I got up to date Friday afternoon and Saturday because I've been on one of these ministry cruises. I was speaking on behalf of a number of people with Young Life. And what's interesting about Young Life is that they're targeting non-Christian youth. They bring them to these killer camps. I mean, they got the best camps in the world. And then they bring in people to help them understand the gospel. But the thing that amazed Kathy and me, except for two of them, none of them had ever heard of Reasons to Believe. And they were just so excited about the content that we have and what it could do for their ministry. So it was really quite a thrill for all of us. But when I got back, I heard about these discoveries a lot of you asked me about. One is in the New York Times. And the title of the New York Times article is Fish's DNA May Explain How Fins Turned to Feet and How Human Beings Came from Fish. So, New York Times has a liberal slant, so it's not at all surprising that they're pushing this evolutionary agenda. That's not a surprise. And really what the article is all about is how they found... Well, I mean, there's these creatures that are kind of by the shore, fish, that live right by the seashore. And instead of having normal fish fins, they've got what they call fleshy fins. And these fleshy fins actually give them the capacity to crawl a little bit along the seashore, in the shallow areas. And the evolutionary idea is that, the fish... Had their fins evolve into fleshy fins, and then they kind of crawled up and got above the surface of the water, decided to go on land, and then these fleshy fins evolved into limbs, And that's where four-footed land animals came from. That's where we came from. So that's kind of the story. And we actually see some of these fish today. And really the story is that these kinds of fish have been around for nearly 400 million years. And so that's kind of a strike against the evolutionary paradigm right away. If this is a transitional form, how come this transitional form sticks around for so long? And how come there's so many different species? Well, from a Psalm 104 perspective, where God is packing the planet with as much life as possible and as diverse as possible for as long as possible, it would make sense that God would create creatures that would be able to thrive in that particular habitat where you're right there by the seashore in shallow water. I mean, if you kind of look at the fins that these creatures had, they're ideally adapted for their environment. It explains why we have them today. It explains why we've had them literally for hundreds of millions of years back into the past. But what excited these researchers is they actually found one of these current species where they were able to actually get a good handle on the genome. Now, most of these creatures have genomes that are far bigger than ours. In fact, one of them has 100 billion gene codes in it. Ours has got, 3 billion? These creatures have a far bigger genome than the human genome. Why? Well, they have a challenging environment to deal with. But no, the news, what got these researchers excited is they found one that had 2.8 billion gene products compared to 3 billion humans. So they said, hey, this is relatively close to typically what we see in the land mammals. And then they were able to code a good chunk of, and they noticed just the similarities between this particular fleshy fin fish and tetrapods that exist today, and say maybe we're actually been able to discern the missing link here. Now, if you want a response to this, my colleague Fuzz Rana, like a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, wrote an article for today's New Reason to Believe, where he made the point that the first fossils of land-dwelling four-limbed animals actually predates that of the earliest fish with fleshy fins by 20 million years, by at least 20 million years. And so this creature can't be the transitional form, because you actually have creatures on the land with fully formed limbs, four-limbed creatures that are existing there 20 million years before the earliest one of these, quote, transitional forms. And so why we see DNA similarities? I mean, we see DNA similarities all over the place. And, Fuzz is now writing a book with the title Common Descent or Common Design, and making the point that the common, if you're taking a creation perspective where God is designing all these creatures, you would actually expect more similarity than you would from an evolutionary model. And so in one sense, this article is evidence for common design rather than common descent, because if it's common descent, you'd actually anticipate far more diversity in the DNA than what we're actually seeing. Fuzz figures it's going to be another year before that book is finished, and it typically takes 8 months to get all the peer review on the book. So, hey, wait a year and a half, you might see that book. But already, he has a lot of articles. If you just kind of type in common design or common descent into your website, you'll see plenty of articles. But the bottom line is, New York Times really doesn't have the appropriate perspective on this. This is really much stronger evidence for common design. Yes?
So the fact that there's 2.8 billion genes?
Not 2.8 billion genes. We're talking about 2.8 billion, I'm trying to think of the technical name for base pairs. Yeah, 2.8 billion base pairs.
Does that mean that it's possible that there could be 2.8 billion animals like that?
No. This is simply the nucleotides that make up the DNA. So, That means on each step of the ladder, you basically have got 2.8 billion steps on the ladder. And it takes a whole lot of these to make up a gene. So we're not talking gene products, we're talking base pairs. But yeah, it's interesting that one species that currently lives on the planet today of these has 100 billion base pairs, not 3 billion like we human beings. So yeah, often we think that we're at the top of the pile in terms of the greatest number of base pairs, but we're not.
A lot of them are wasted, it seems like.
Well, I mean, that's research going on right now. A lot of people thought that, we human beings have 3 billion, which looks like way more than what we need. Is there a lot of waste and junk in there? But we're now recognizing that what we thought was waste and junk isn't. I mean, what would be interesting is to go into this creature that's got 100 billion and see what's going on there. But that research hasn't been done yet. But I think that would be really a really good project to undertake, because it is one of the biggest genomes of any creature that we've been able to study. So, but again, I'm just guessing. Given the challenges that this creature is dealing with, I'm not surprised that it has such a huge number of base pairs. Okay. Yes. Well, I mean, you can read Fuzz's article on this. This has been textbook stuff for, 30, 50 years, that there was this thick fin or fleshly fin creature that lived at the seashore that was a transitional form for all the land animals. So that's been textbook stuff for years. It's only been in the last year and a half to 2 years that that's been challenged. And one reason why Fuzz wrote the article is that this challenge was published in a journal that very few people read. And so so that's one reason why we got up on our website, because it's not common knowledge that the first tetrapod considerably predates the so-called transitional form.
There's no source that people can go to look for that kind of thing on the internet. Oh,
there is. Because I'm trying to remember which journal it was published in.
Just to find that there was a tetrapod.
Well, a tetrapod is just a generic name for any land animal that has four limbs.
But you would think there'd be something on the internet now that one could go to find out the timeline, basically, of these things, right?
Well, you will find easily on the internet a date for the first, quote, transitional form creature that lived at the seashore that had fleshy fins. That date comes in, I think, at about 390 million years ago. But 420 million years ago, you got tetrapods on the land masses.
Yeah, that's my point. That doesn't show on that timeline, huh?
If you dig deep enough on the internet, I'll bet you'll find it. So,
that's just amazing.
Probably the first thing you're going to find is Fuzz's article. Yes.
Did anybody send this article to the Times?
I don't think so. No, this article was not written by a scientist. It was written by a guy who interviewed scientists.
No, but I mean, you guys should be doing that. Every one of these, send the proof to it. See if they'll actually publish that.
Well, that might be good to do. I mean, this was handed to me when I came back, and this was published, I think, a week ago.
You guys can have a lot of fun with that,
So. Actually, it's pretty recent. It's April 17th. I thought it was 18. So it is fairly new. But something even newer is something a lot of you have heard of, is this announcement from NASA that they have found, quote, two water worlds. Actually, if you go to the NASA website, what they're saying is, we have found the two smallest planets that could be water worlds, planets in which liquid water could exist on its surface. And the NASA article is actually fairly conservative in what it's claiming. And indeed, they're right. These are the two smallest planets that have been found. However, what they define as small is size, not mass. Because these are two planets discovered by the Kepler satellite. And typically, that satellite is able to accurately measure the masses of the planets. In this case, they don't have enough data to come in with masses of the planets. In fact, all they can really tell is that they have less than 25 times the mass of the Earth. But hey, it could be all the way down to 2 times the mass of the Earth. So there's a big uncertainty in the mass. What they were able to measure, however, was the diameter of the planets. And one of the planets came in at 1.4 times the diameter of the Earth. The other came in at 1.6 times the diameter of the Earth. And so indeed, they are the smallest planets that has ever been discovered outside of our solar system in terms of the diameters of the planets, where there is a possibility that they could have liquid water. And I do like the NASA's article because they made the point possible. They're not claiming that it's probable. But they're basically saying it will have liquid water if you got the just right atmosphere on that particular planet. But change the atmosphere ever so slightly, as they point out, you're going to get a runaway freeze or a runaway evaporation of the water. Yeah, the planet will have water, but it won't be in a liquid state. And you know, I'm glad that NASA is actually admitting this, because for a long time they were not really describing just how incredibly fine-tuned the atmosphere of a planet must be for there to be liquid water on the surface. In fact, that's true of our planet Earth. Our planet Earth has had 4 episodes where almost all the water on our planet turned into a frozen state, what they call snowball events. And you say, well, how much were we talking about? We're talking about an ice age that goes down to about 10 degrees above the equator. So virtually all of the planet was turned into an ice ball. Including the oceans, right. So, and, you know, what got the planet out of that ice ball was the fact that our planet has aggressive plate tectonic activity. And so eventually enough carbon dioxide and methane was released into the atmosphere from volcanic eruptions that caused the planet to warm up enough to melt the ice. By the way, today an ice ball event is impossible. We can still get ice ages, but not an ice ball. The reason why it's impossible is because every year the sun burns, it gets a little brighter. And today the sun is too bright for a snowball event to take place. However, as the sun continues to brighten, we're going to lose all of our liquid water, because it won't be long before the sun is so bright that all of our liquid water will turn into steam.
And how long is that?
How long is that?
Should I get my clock?
Well, I can put it this way. The first thing that's going to happen is that human technology will become impossible. Then human life will become impossible. Then bacterial life will become impossible. And then there will be no liquid water. Now, in terms of when it's going to be impossible to sustain global high technology civilization, we're looking at just thousands of years before that happens. In terms of when human life will be impossible, somewhere between 1 and 5 million years, maybe 10 million years if you really push it, the sun will be too bright to sustain us. Within 30 million years, the planet will become sterile. The sun will be too bright for life to be sustained anywhere. And then within 100 million years, the water will be gone. So, yeah.
In that time period, the sun is going to become less stable. I mean, it's the most stable object in the universe right now. I imagine as it gets older, it can get less stable also.
Well, that's one reason why global high technology human civilization won't be possible, because in less than 50,000 years, the sun is going to exit its stable luminosity phase. And that will allow human life to exist at, say, a low population, Stone Age level technology, but the kind of civilization we have today would not be sustainable. So that would be 50,000 years. The reason why I said thousands of years, trying to sustain global high technology civilization has consequences for human DNA and for your population level. And so the problem with wealth and technology is that it drops the birth rate, causes people to give birth to children at a later and later age, which has effects on the genome. And so this is why a number of people interested in the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life have said, in terms of high technology civilization, it can't be sustained anywhere in our galaxy for more than about 2,000 years. Although some have said 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. So,
at what point are we in that 1,000 years? When does high tech start in our history?
Well, okay, the people who have been writing papers on this say once you have a technology at the level we had at the end of World War II. So that's what, 60 years?
Radio.
Transistors and the radar and computer technology begins to emerge, jet aircraft, that kind of thing, communication systems, atomic bombs, exactly. So
I was curious where that fuzzy line would be.
So I mean, if you're a pessimist, we only got 950 years left. If you're an optimist, we have 1,930 years left. So. But there's always a fix. Give up all your technology and give up your high population, you can last a lot longer. But that's one reason why a number of researchers who are actually studying the topic of extraterrestrial intelligence have said populations, once they get into a high-tech situation, inevitably go extinct. Why? Because they will not give up their technology. And if you don't give up the technology, you will go extinct. Yeah, I mean, the extraterrestrial intelligent life literature is filled with articles that talk about the maximum longevity of an intelligent civilization. And, actually the pessimists go all the way down to 50 years, which makes the point that, once you get high tech, people begin to exterminate themselves with conflicts. But hey, we're already past that 50-year period, and we haven't gone extinct yet. The kind of the hard limits are between 1 and 2,000 years. Yes.
Can you explain how, if the sun is burning out, that it gets brighter and hotter?
Okay. Why the sun gets brighter and hotter is that the sun's furnace in its core is basically a gigantic hydrogen bomb, where it's taking hydrogen and fusing it to make helium. And E equals mc squared. Four hydrogen atoms weigh more than one helium atom. So when you fuse hydrogen into helium, the mass difference gets converted into energy. And so that's why a hydrogen bomb is just so energetic, and explains why our physicists today want to make a fusion reactor, because a fusion reactor will deliver a whole lot more power than a nuclear fission reactor. Well, they're basically trying to copy what's going on in the sun to get energy. However, when you're fusing hydrogen into helium, you're increasing the density of the core of the sun. And because the density is greater, that greater density causes the fusion reaction to burn faster than it would if you got less helium. So as the sun converts hydrogen to helium, the density goes up, which causes the furnace to burn faster and faster, hence the sun gets hotter and hotter and more luminous. And this has been going on for the past, about 4 billion years. The sun's been getting...
Isn't that
in
other stars?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's something you see in all stars. It's something that I was forced to do when I was a first-year graduate student in astronomy. It was to develop a sophisticated stellar model which predicts the whole burning history of the star. I mean, it's an amazing exercise we give to physics and astronomy students, because, in fact, this is part of our lesson. Psalm 147, we're talking about stars. Stars are incredibly simple. They're basically just giant balls of gas, where almost all the gas is hydrogen and helium. And because they're just giant balls of gas, where almost all the gas is hydrogen and helium, you can use straightforward differential equations to predict in detail the birth, burning history, and the death of a star. And then you can compare your theoretical model with actual observations of stars in galaxies all over the universe. And it's such that our theoretical models for the burning history of stars match the observations to a very high degree of precision. And it's about the only place in all of physics where you get that kind of detailed match between theory and observations. And the reason is because stars are so incredibly simple. Okay? But that actually ties into our lesson in Psalm 147. The whole idea that stars are incredibly simple and we human beings are incredibly complex. I mean, you know, stars are bigger than us, but they have nowhere near the complexity that we have. Anyway, I'm kind of tipping my hand in the lesson. Yes?
I wanted to ask you, could you explain, it sounded like you were saying that a decreasing birth rate produced at later periods of life is bad for the genome, and could you explain why?
Okay. With high technology, there's pressure to put off marriage and bearing of children.
Why?
Why? Well, I'm a perfect example of that, okay? I've got a PhD in astronomy, and it took me... I mean, I got my PhD in my discipline faster than any of my colleagues, but it took 5.5 years of research beyond the bachelor's degree to get my thesis done, thesis defense, etc. Well, guess what? That made me 27 years old before I got my doctorate degree. And then I came to Caltech as a low-paid postdoctoral fellow. Okay, when we start thinking about marriage, and this actually happened, this is the amount of money I'm making, this is what's going to cost to maintain a household. Then you start thinking about what it's going to cost to have children. And you say, I'm going to have to put this off to get a little better established in my career. Because I'm not in a position to make that happen financially right now. Whereas if you were to go back, say, 1,000 years, where people were raised on a farm, and by the time they're 10 years of age, they're working on the farm. By the time they're 17, they know the farming business backwards and forwards. They're ready to marry and have a family and have sufficient income to sustain the family. Well, that's an option for very few people living in the United States of America today. Amen. As I'm watching my own sons, I got two sons that are 24 and 27. Neither one of them thinks that they're well enough established in terms of their education and their careers to get married and have a family. So they're putting that off, just like I had to put it off. Now, what that means is that when you do start having children, you're going to be passing on more deleterious mutations to your children than you would if you were having those children at an earlier age.
Why?
Why? Well, it's not so much a problem for the woman. It's basically a problem for the man. And that's an interesting issue because men typically marry at a later age than women by a few years. And the thing about men is that their DNA degrades as they get older and older. And so... I'll give you another example. I once did a conference for the Martama denomination out of India. And, very strong evangelical Christian denomination. And they want to reach India for Christ, and particularly the leaders in India. And they say the way we're going to do it, we're going to get our children established in significant careers, which means almost all their children have doctorates. But they advise their children, do not marry until both the woman and the man are well established in their careers, which means they're typically getting married in their 30s. And what I noticed was just the high proportion of Mongoloid children in that particular sect, for the simple reason that the probability of giving birth to a Mongoloid goes up as you get older and older when you have your children. And that's just not the only example. Lots of problems arise as you get older and older, which means that you're basically degrading the genome by having children later on in life. That's one issue. The other issue is the problem I've already outlined. In a high-technology civilization, particularly if you live in a dense city, it costs a lot of money to have a child. Not just to have a child, but to raise a child to the point where that child is able to sustain himself or herself. And so, for example, I was in Hong Kong a year and a half ago. Almost everybody there, well, in fact, I didn't meet anybody that didn't have at least a bachelor's degree. Why? Because that's the minimum just to get a job serving in a restaurant. And yeah, I mean, it's starting to get like that here too. I mean, so it means people, put off getting married. It also means it's going to cost a lot more for you as a parent to get your child established. And so right now in America, they estimate that for every child you have, it's going to cost you at least $250,000. Okay, if you have four children, that's $1 million you got to invest. Now, how many of us actually can afford to spend $1 million in the course of 20 years just on our children? And so that causes people to think twice about having children, which is why the birth rate is dropping in all urban high technology centers around the world. In fact, it really doesn't matter how much you encourage people to have children. They look at the bottom line and say, no, we're going to only have two kids. We're only going to have one. Or a lot of them saying, we're not going to get married. We're not going to have any kids at all. And so birth rates are dropping everywhere where you've got technology and wealth. And we had a member of the class here who was a professor at, UC Northridge. And he said some studies he's seen predict that by the year 2100, we're looking at only 1 billion human beings on the face of the earth. A sevenfold drop in population is conceivable if we continue to see increasing wealth and technology. Yes?
Wasn't that prophesied in the Bible, that the bottom would be more fruitful than the...
Yeah, there are people who've claimed that this is predicted in the Bible using phrases. I mean, there's some references to the effect that people become self-centered and, they're going to be focusing on money. That is human nature just based on our sin issue. The reason why the birth rates increase in rural areas, the more children you have, the more money you have. If you go back to 1776, revolutionary America, you know how many children were being born to every woman on the average? 10. It was 10 per woman here in the United States. That was the average. Why was it so high? The more children you had, the bigger farm you could have. The bigger farm you could have, the more money was available to the family.
And they didn't all live either, though.
They didn't all live.
38%.
But it was all economics, exactly. So people have children according to the economics. But now that we live in cities, having a lot of children isn't... I mean, as one investor told me, never invest in anything that eats. So horse races, children. Yes.
Going back to this planet they found, and it was obviously they talked a lot about the planet, but of course not a lot about the star. And based on what we know about stars, that star obviously can't support life at all, I understand, right? It's not stable.
Well, that is something I was going to mention. All this talk about these planets that could have liquid water on it if they got a fine-tuned atmosphere. If you look at the star, Kepler 62, it is less than 70% the mass of our star, the Sun, 21% the brightness of our Sun, and it's about 7 billion years old. And so look at the characteristics of the star that immediately rules out the possibility that you could have any kind of advanced life on any of the planets in the system, because the planet is so dim that in order for the planet to have liquid water, you got to move the planet a lot closer to the star. Moving it closer to the star means it's going to be tidally locked in one way or form, which means you're not going to have a 24-hour rotation period. What do you mean by tidal locking? Our moon is tidally locked to the Earth. It's so close to the Earth that the gravity of the Earth forces one side to always face the Earth. That's why you never see the back side of the moon. You only see the front side because it's tidally locked. Likewise, Mercury and Venus are tidally locked to our Sun. Earth is far enough away where it doesn't get tidally locked. And that's one reason why life is possible on the Earth, but not possible on Venus or Mercury. These planets are too close to avoid some form of a tidal locking. Moreover, the star is faint enough that it's not going to have the stability of the sun. As you get to smaller stars, they flare more dramatically than the sun, and their luminosity is more erratic than the sun. Those are also strikes against life. Although, as the authors point out, if you fine-tune everything, maybe you can have bacteria existing on the planets for a few years. But trying to have bacteria exist for billions of years, which is a crucial requirement to have any kind of advanced life, that indeed is ruled out just by looking at the characteristics of the star. Now, what I'm excited about is, okay, let's get some more measurements and see what the real properties of these planets are. We really don't know much about these planets. All we know is the distance from the star and the size of the planets. We don't yet know the mass, and we don't yet have the orbit pinned down very accurately. So this is a wait-and-see situation. But what is exciting is that the Kepler satellite is able to find planets that are small, just like the Earth. And if we can get the radius and the mass, then we can learn something about the atmosphere. And one thing they pointed out, given that they have radii bigger than the Earth, chances are that if they do have liquid water, they're what we call super water worlds, which means they have oceans that are thousands of miles deep. And if you've got oceans that are thousands of miles deep, you're not going to have continents. And if you're not going to have continents, you won't have the nutrient recycling that's going to make any kind of advanced life possible, even in the ocean. So you're basically stuck with only unicellular life forms at best. Yes?
It seems to me that if bacterial life is possible, even for a short time, it raises an interesting question of how in the world did that life develop and what does its DNA look like?
Well, you get an origin of life problem.
Origin of life problem.
Right. So, and actually what's not in this article, but I also saw it come out last week, is a discovery of what they call eyeball Earths. An eyeball Earth is an Earth with an ice surface where it's tidally locked and where the tidal locking actually heats the water below the ice. A good analogy to that would be Europa, which may or may not be an eyeball moon. Europa is 35% water, compared to 0.03% for the Earth. But Europa is tidally locked to some degree to Jupiter, and there's speculation that that tidal locking might actually heat the water below the frozen surface of Europa. We don't know yet, but that's a possibility. But there's a lot of excitement about trying to discover what they call these eyeball Earths. But I've written an article, in fact it's in our book Origins of Life, why eyeball Earths are not a suitable site for the origin of life. Chemically, you can't make an origin of life work on an eyeball moon or planet. You're going to have that liquid water on its surface. But again, what I'm excited about is that if we can get some decent measurements here, we can test what seems to be a leading hypothesis that Earth-like planets have very deep oceans. And it's one of the things that's unique about the Earth is that it has a thin layer of water on its surface and not a very thick layer of water. Water, after all, is the second most abundant molecule in the universe. And so the issue in terms of advanced life is finding a place that's water poor, not water rich. Yes?
So it seems to me that since we all came from the Big Bang, everything came from the Big Bang, and we developed on this planet, why do you think that the cosmos would be full of planets with life, since they're all made of atoms and particles, the same thing we are? So why couldn't that be true?
Well, what probably is true, at least for our galaxy, is that our galaxy is loaded with planets. Although I'm a little bit skeptical that it's as full as some of these NASA scientists think. Because we're really only able to discover planets that are relatively close to the Earth. And one of the things we know is that you get the highest probability for planet formation at the radius from the center of the galaxy that we are. So what remains to be seen is the density of planets in the center of our galaxy and the outer edge of our galaxy. We do know the planets are plentiful, at the Earth radius from the center of our galaxy. But even so, that still adds up to many millions of planets and possibly even billions of planets. But the question is, how many Earth-like planets do you see? And keep in mind, the scientific community defines an Earth-like planet as a planet that's the same size as the Earth and the same distance from its star, where the star is relatively similar to the Sun. While it takes a lot more Earth-similar characteristics than just those three to get a planet that can possibly sustain life, there's actually several hundred other characteristics that must be brought into play for a planet to be able to sustain life.
Does it have to be Earth-like? I mean, we're made of the same material, so it doesn't have to be Earth-like, it seems to me, to have life.
Well, again, it depends what kind of life. One thing you'll see in our website is I kind of list the characteristics you need to have simple bacteria existing on a body for 3 months or less. And that's a lot less challenging than trying to have bacteria that exists for 3 billion years, which is a lot less challenging than having multicellular life, which is a lot less challenging than having advanced land life, you know, like birds, mammals, reptiles, and amphibians. And then human beings would be the most challenging of all. But even to get bacteria that lasts for just a few months, over 350 different features have to be fine-tuned for a planet to be able to sustain that kind of bacteria. And that does not address the origin of the bacteria problem. You know, one of the things we know, for example, about certain moons is, yes, we could conceive of maybe a bacterium living in one of those environments, but it'd be impossible for it to originate in that environment. Then the question is, if it's not possible to originate in that environment, how does it get there? How does it penetrate 30 miles of ice to get to the liquid water below? That's the problem with the eyeball moons and planets, is that if you can't have life originate there, it doesn't seem feasible that life could actually get there from some external source. So, again, there's a lot more than just the distance and the temperature that you got to deal with in order for life to be feasible. And then, for any kind of multicellular life, it's crucial to be able to recycle nutrients. And in order to recycle them sufficiently, you're going to need continents and oceans on the surface. And that's something that I think would be very exciting in these extrasolar planets. So far, all the evidence tells us that only exists on planet Earth. We could have literally billions of planets, but just one that has continents and oceans on its surface. Yes? Pardon me? We came from the Big Bang? Well, I mean, okay. The Big Bang creation event is responsible for all the elements we see in the universe, the 92 naturally occurring elements we see in the face of the Earth. And all life is made from those 92 elements. So it's kind of what one of my former professors said, we all come from stardust, because our bodies are basically made up of the elements that have been made inside the furnaces of stars. But that doesn't mean that the Big Bang created us. It just simply means that whoever created the Big Bang designed it in such a way that it would reproduce all the elements that are essential for life. One of the things we're finding, for example, with these Earth-like planets, they're coming in mineral poor. You'll see an article I wrote on our website that if you don't have a long history of life on a planet, you're basically only going to get about 60 to 70 minerals on that planet. But if you want advanced life, you're going to need over 4,500 minerals. And you're not going to get those 4,500 minerals unless you've got 3.5 billion years minimum of a life history on the planet. So it takes a creator introducing life of just the right quantity, just the right sequence, of just the right diversity, simply to build up all the minerals you're going to need to have, for example, birds and mammals and human beings. So yeah, the elements all came from stars, but it takes the intervention of a creator creating specific life forms to transform all those elements into the thousands of minerals that we need to make advanced life possible. So Yeah, it's not as simple as what people think. Okay, I've got 10 minutes left. All right. Psalm 147 and 148. These are the last two creation psalms that we're studying in this lesson on the creation texts in the Bible. And both of them focus on stars. Psalm 147 begins this way: how good it is to sing praises to our God, how pleasant and fitting to praise Him. The Lord builds up Jerusalem. He gathers the exiles of Israel. He heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds. So here he's talking about the care that he shows towards human beings that think that nobody cares for them. That's kind of how verses 2 and 3 are talking about. And verse 4, God, He determines the number of the stars and calls each of them by name. Great is our Lord and mighty in power. His understanding has no limit. The Lord sustains the humble but casts the wicked to the ground. And so what I wanted to do, and obviously I'm not going to be able to finish it in the 8 minutes that remain here, is give you a little insight as to what it takes to get the stars that we need to make life possible, and just how many stars there are. It says He determines the number of the stars. He calls each of them by name, which tells us something about the care that God puts into the stars. But notice that the two verses before that are talking about God's care for people who think nobody cares. And He uses the analogy, look, I even care for the stars. If I care enough for the stars to give each of them a name, don't you think I care for you who think that nobody cares? That's kind of the theme of the first few verses of Psalm 147. And only in the last few years, in fact only, yeah, just the last several years, have we been able to determine the number of stars in the observable universe. So what I wanted to do is just show you how it was that astronomers were able to actually come up with a number of stars in the universe. But this psalm has been written, you know, thousands of years ago, and only now do we know the actual number of stars. But people living even thousands of years ago, I think, at least had the idea there's got to be a lot of them. And, you know, earlier on in Genesis, as we've studied, it talks about how the stars are as numerous as the grains of sand in all the seashores of the world. Well, there's a lot of grains of sand in the seashores, and the stars are that numerous. It also talks about the number of people who receive salvation are going to be countless, just like you can't count the stars or the grains of sand. But now we can actually count the number of stars. So I want to show you how that was done, and then also segue from that into recognizing how each star plays the critical role in making human life possible in the universe. There's not a single star that's wasted. Every star counts. And there's a lot more stars than there are human beings. Okay, if I can bring this up here, just at least to introduce this. We were able, and if we could actually dim the lights here, this would help. This is a photo of the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's soon to be replaced by the James Webb Telescope, which will actually be able to give us a much more accurate count of the total number of stars in the universe. But hey, this instrument was good enough to show us the number of stars to at least within a factor of 10. And the project that did this took place about 3 years ago, where they used the Hubble Space Telescope and decided to focus on one tiny part of the sky for 1 million seconds. Now, in astronomy, the longer you take an image, the longer time you take the image, the fainter stars you can see. And it goes up with the square root. So, for example, if you observe a certain patch of the sky for 4 hours, you can see stars that are twice as dim as you can if you only take observations for 1 hour. And so by looking at a small patch of the sky for a very long period of time, you can see very, very faint objects. And so this is the longest exposure on one patch of the sky that astronomers have ever done. Literally 1 million seconds, which is about 2 weeks total exposure. Now, you know, I was raised in Canada, and we were actually doing these kinds of astronomical observations because in Canada you can go far enough north where in the wintertime you get a nice dark sky for about 22 hours. And so we would do these 22-hour exposures. Then the sun would come up, or the twilight would get too bright, and we'd have to stop. But because this is in outer space, you're actually able to integrate literally for a couple of weeks. Now, the patch of sky they chose was a place in the sky where there are no bright stars and no bright galaxies. They picked a very dark spot in the sky because they wanted to be able to observe the faintest galaxies that were possible. And the goal was to see all the galaxies that exist in a small patch of the sky. So they picked a patch of the sky that's 1/10 of a moon diameter across, 3 arc minutes. So a very small patch of the sky, and this is the photograph or the image that they took, known as the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. And you notice that there's only a couple of faint stars. Stars are the things where you see crosses on it. So, for example, this up here is a star. Let me see if there's another one on the image. I really don't see anything else. So it's just that one star. Everything else you see here is a galaxy. So these are all galaxies. Now, can you show you on this side? Sure. I showed you on that side because there's less light. It's easier to see. But this is a star because you can see the cross-like thing, which is basically the mounting part for the secondary lens. And so a star will show that as a cross, a galaxy won't, because a galaxy is a little bit, it's got a larger image. So everything else in here is galaxies. Now, what I'm going to do in the next slide is show you kind of a zooming in on a smaller part of the sky. And when you do that, you can see the fainter galaxies show up. And then this one here, where you can see, and again, if it was perfectly dark, you would see that this image is just filled with thousands of galaxies. Some bright like these, but most of them just little tiny specks.
What's the range?
What's the range?
Billion light years.
Well, you're literally seeing galaxies as far away as 13.2 billion light years. You know, and that's something that they were checking out. In fact, since this image has been taken, astronomers have actually measured the distances to all these galaxies. And the most distant ones are about 13.2 billion light years away, 13.3. And, it takes about a half billion years for a galaxy to form after the Big Bang creation event. So given that the universe is about 13.8 billion years old, that means we are indeed seeing galaxies all the way back to the very first galaxies that can form. Yes, in the back.
Is this the picture that they have on the wall down at Griffith Park Observatory?
No, that's not the photo they have on the wall. The photo they have on the wall at the Griffith Observatory shows you a cross-section of the Virgo cluster. And the Virgo cluster of galaxies is the nearest really large cluster of galaxies. Matter of fact, our Milky Way galaxy is part of the Virgo supercluster of galaxies. Only we're on the outer fringe. And so that little strip that they see in the wall there is a cross-section of the center of the Virgo cluster of galaxies. But yeah, not only can you see galaxies in that photograph at the Griffith Observatory, you can actually see globular clusters that surround all the larger galaxies in the Virgo cluster. And so that's important. It actually fits into what we're talking about, because what we're seeing here is galaxies that are very far away, but we could use that photo that you see at the Griffith Observatory to say, okay, that's what galaxies look like far away. What do galaxies look like up close? Because there we can add the contribution of the globular clusters. We can add the contribution of the dwarf galaxies. The distant galaxies here, you cannot see dwarf galaxies. You can only see the large galaxies and the medium-sized galaxies. And so it's necessary to get a total count of the number of galaxies in the universe to add the contribution of dwarf galaxies. But that's easy to do because you can look at the nearby cluster of galaxies, the Virgo cluster, and you can actually count the ratio of the dwarf galaxies to the medium and large galaxies, count the number of globular clusters that surround these galaxies, And hey, that's what I'm going to do for you when I come back 2 weeks from today, is show you how we're able to come up with a detailed count of the number of galaxies and the number of stars. But it's a combination of the Hubble Ultra Deep Field and then very deep observations of nearby clusters of galaxies that enables us to actually come up with a figure of how many stars exist in the entire observable universe. But just this one tiny patch, we're looking at 3 arc minutes, just 1/10 of a moon diameter. They counted over 10,000 large and medium-sized galaxies. Okay, now that number needs to be complemented by the equivalent of what we saw on that big wall. And by the way, I've never been to the Griffith Observatory. To me, that was a highlight of seeing that image. It's 100 feet long and about 20 feet tall. And you can actually go up there with a magnifying glass like this, and you can see little faint clusters of stars around the galaxies in the center of the Virgo cluster.
There's some dark patches in there. What happened?
Pardon me?
There's some dark patches in there. What happened?
Well, I mean,
it's totally dark. They look, they got. Is there any patches in the universe that are totally dark? I don't think there are.
Yeah, there are.
There are?
Yeah.
Anyway, there's no stars or galaxies or anything?
Well, the Big Bang creation model predicts that you're going to get voids and then filaments. And so if you were to try to map all the galaxies in the universe, you'd notice that the galaxies and galaxy clusters tend to clump together along big walls and filaments, and in between you have empty voids. And that's actually crucial to get life in the universe, that you have that kind of a structure in the universe. And it's actually got to be fine-tuned. The voids have to be certain sizes, and the walls and filaments have to be certain sizes and densities. So, yeah, if you look in the void, there's not much there.
It's not distributed at all.
It's not, well, I mean, it is evenly distributed if you don't use a magnifying glass. In other words, if you look at it at very low resolution, that's kind of what you see when you look at the cosmic background radiation. You're looking at the universe at such, you know, low resolution that you really don't see the clumps and the voids. But once you start looking at it with a detail like this, then you do. And the Sloan Digital Sky Survey project was designed to measure in detail the walls, the filaments, and the voids. And you can actually go online and see some detailed maps of those voids.
We're going to keep getting more and more resolution, right? With
right.
New telescopes and satellites.
Yeah, well, as I said, the James Webb Telescope is going to be orbited soon, and it's going to have 16 times the light gathering power of the Hubble Space Telescope. And so they'll be able to redo this Hubble Ultra Deep Field and be able to see much smaller galaxies than what this one can. But even this is adequate to give us a fairly accurate count of the total number of stars in the universe. So 2 weeks from today, we'll get that number.
I pray and to thank the Lord for each one of those stars that we can be here.
Right.
I'm not going to do them by name. He knows the name of each one of them. We're just going to thank the Lord for all.
That's a good one. Father in heaven, we do thank you for every single star that you created. And Lord, we thank you that because of each one of those stars, we can be here to praise you. And Lord, we thank you that everything we see in the universe is a cause to give you praise for what you've done on our behalf. Thank you, Lord, for the degree of care that you express in each of those stars, and even how much more care you express for each one of us. Thank you, Lord, that you know the name of every single star, and you know its purpose and value in making our existence possible. And Lord, of course, you know our name and our purpose and our value. Help us to discover, Lord, why you created us, specifically what our purpose and value is. And Lord, I pray that you would give us even a stronger motivation to fulfill that very purpose for which you've created us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.